If people could take their seats, I think we should get underway because time is of the essence in this place, as we all know. But firstly, welcome to this Vital Issues seminar, and I'm very pleased to have been asked to chair this particular session. The Indonesian elections 2009, how the system works and what the parties stand for. We have two prominent guest speakers who will give us an introduction, which I'm quite sure will lead to some questions later on. A special welcome to the members of the Indonesian Embassy who are with us here today. I'm sure you're looking forward with interest to the Indonesian elections as well. And as someone personally who was involved, as I was saying, to our friends here in taking an Australian delegation to the Indonesian elections in 1999, I too have a particular interest in what has taken place since then and what may take place in the future. Our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Sherlock. Stephen's a political analyst and development consultant who specialises in governments and political change in the Asia-Pacific region. He holds a master's degree and doctorate in Asian politics and history from the University of Sydney. He has an expertise in political systems, political parties, electoral systems, public sector reform, legislative strengthening and anti-corruption. He has published widely on Indonesian politics and governments. Dr. Sherlock entered the Australian Agency for International Development, AusAid, as a graduate recruit in 1990. He then worked for 11 years as an analyst on Indonesia, East Timor, and the South Pacific for the Australian Parliament, and he provided research and analysis for members of Parliament and parliamentary committees and produced publications on political and economic developments in the region. Since leaving the Parliament service in 2001, Dr. Sherlock has been an independent consultant working for a wide range of Australian and international organisations on projects involving research and analysis, training and seminars, project appraisal, development, implementation and assessment. His clients have included the World Bank, United Nations Development Programme, the Asian Development Bank, AusAid, the Centre for Democratic Institutions at the ANU and the National Democratic Institute and the Frederick Neumann Stiftung. So as you can see, Dr. Sherlock has a very broad very broad experience, and we welcome him here today to address us. Thank you, Stephen.
Who in there? Did you sign on? It was going fine, but it must have been just left.
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
This is one more time.
That looks better. First of all, I apologise if I'm sounding very, very croaky. It's because I am, because I have a bad dose of the flu, but it's getting better and I'm battling on. So if you forgive the sound of my voice, we'll see how we go. All right, well, the first point, I just wanted to make a couple of general observations that I think are often not made enough in the Australian media, in Australian political discourse and observation about Indonesia. And that is really just to recognise how much progress there has been made in Indonesia in the last 10 years in terms of political and institutional change. And we can say now, I think, that Indonesia is a well-functioning presidential democracy. And that if you compare it, in fact, with most of the countries in the Southeast Asian region, Indonesia looks very good. If we think about the events that have occurred in Thailand in the last couple of years, continuing issues about governance in countries like Malaysia and Singapore, not to mention places, countries like Burma. So the progress that Indonesia has made, I think, is quite impressive and often not recognised. If we look at the sort of questions that were being asked at different times, we can see how this progress has been marked. in the 1999 elections, for example. The sort of questions that analysts were asking, the media were asking, was things, very basic things, like, will this election be free and fair? Will it be a real election? Will there be violence? Will the military allow a political process to go ahead? Very basic questions of democracy were being asked. But it all went off very well. And in 2004, those sort of questions were no longer being asked. The most important question probably was, with the institution of a system of direct presidential election, will that system work? Will the election succeed? Will the system then work when it's put in place? And for those questions, the answer has basically been yes. And now, third time around, in 2009, the issue is really about refining the system, refining and developing the system. In my opinion, some of the changes that have been happening in the last year are questionable, but the point is that it's refinements of detail. We're no longer dealing with very basic questions. And in more general terms, Indonesia is now in what we might call a second stage of democratisation, of development of democratic governance. Very important new institutions have become very active and had a lot of political effect, like the Anti-Corruption Commission making real inroads into corruption, the Constitutional Court having a great deal of impact, as I will show later on, in the development of legislation. All right, if anyone remembers the Knoll year of living dangerously, well, I'm not the first person to use this, but we could call 2009 the year of voting frequently, because there will be five elections and possibly six that will take place during the next 8-9 months. The first of those, the biggest, will happen only just a month or so away, on the 9th of April, all the legislative elections, and that's very much a plural, because not only are there elections for the National Parliament, the DPR, but there are also elections for the other national representative body, the Regional Representative Council, but also at the provincial level, elections are taking place, and at the district level, also elections are taking place. I have parliaments there in inverted commas, because those bodies are sort of legislative bodies, but they're not actually able to pass laws. It's something we might talk about later, perhaps. But they have a status, they're not like state parliaments in our system. They have a status in the hierarchy which is below the national government. So all of those things are happening on one day. Voters have four ballot papers and four choices to make. And then on the 8th of July, the presidential elections will occur. As I say there, that's for the first round, and if it should emerge that no single candidate has a majority of votes, there'll be a second round election which will take place on the 8th of September. Just reiterating that this is the third parliamentary election that has taken place, 1999, 2004 and now 2009. And the second direct presidential election. Previously, the president was voted for within the parliament, 2004 and now 2009. Now, it's important to understand that the Indonesian system is based around a five-year fixed cycle. It's not flexible like it is in most Westminster systems like our own. Beginning with those four legislative elections that I talked about, the DPR, the DPD, and then the two provincial and district levels, those results are then counted. There are two important thresholds which have to be met as a result of those elections. The first is a 2.5% threshold. That is that any party that doesn't receive 2.5% of the national vote cannot win seats in Parliament. That's a new change we can talk about in a moment. So that will eliminate a lot of the smaller parties. And then there is a 20% threshold for candidates to become, for people to become presidential candidates. Then there is a period that's of what we would call in English horse trading, but in Indonesian is called cow trading. Bargaining negotiations that go on between the parties, largely about who will form the pairs, that is the Vice President and President or pairs of candidates for the presidential election. And there will also be a lot of caltrading going on about cabinet positions during that period as well. Once the candidates have all been established, the first round takes place. To win in that round, a candidate has to win 50% plus one of the votes, but also has to win 20% of the votes in 66% of the provinces. That's to ensure that a candidate doesn't have his or her votes all concentrated in one area, in Java, for example. If there's no candidate that emerges that meets those thresholds, the second round happens and it's a simple majority. And of course, with two candidates or two pairs of candidates, one of those will win more than 50%. Then in October, the DPR and the DPD, the two chambers of the National Parliament, are inaugurated, and that has to happen first because the swearing-in of the President and the Vice-President happens in this body called the MPR. Don't really have to have time to go into that, but it's made up of the members of the DPR and the DPD. And one of its functions is to inaugurate the President. And then 5 years later, in 2014, the same cycle will commence. And it is a mammoth undertaking. 170 million voters, at least. The figures are a matter of dispute. This is possibly one of the problems of the accuracy of the electoral roll, but there are somewhere around 170 million voters. And in 33 provinces, because remember, there are provincial elections happening at the same time, so as well as this national election, there are elections happening in 33 provinces and 489 districts. All of them happening on the same day. And the 77 electoral districts for the DPR. 600,000 voting stations, polling booths as we would call them, and 11,800 candidates in the DPR. And it's administered by this body, the General Elections Commission. We might perhaps talk about the issues about that body at some stage later. All right, the first of those elections. The DPR, the House of Representatives, has 560 members and is elected on a proportional representation system. So there are multi-member electoral districts, but unlike, say, in the Australian Senate, where we also have proportional representation, the electorates are not the same size. They vary from 3 seats per district in quite small provinces because they exist within one province, to 10 seats per district in larger provinces. And that's the point that I was making, is that because the electoral districts cannot cross provincial boundaries, that very much changes the size of the electoral districts. And therefore, of course, in small electoral districts like one with three seats, it's very difficult for a small party to win, but in larger seats like in West Java, where there is 11 districts up till 10 seats, it's of course much easier for a small party to win a seat, having to only get 10% of the vote as distinct from 33% in a 3-seat district. Now, I won't go into this too much because this is what Greg is going to be talking about, but I just thought I would introduce to you what I call the Big Seven parties. I'm doing that because not only will I mention these parties from time to time, but also because there is an impression that you get through the media that there is this huge number of parties and everyone's confused about the number of parties and Parliament doesn't work very well because there's too many parties, blah, blah, blah. The reality is that 90% of people vote for these Big Seven parties, and 90% of the seats are taken up by that. That's Golkar, most people are probably aware of, PDIP, that is Megawati Sukarnoputri's party, the Democrat Party, the party of the current president, and these other four are different types of Islamic parties. As I said, I don't want to go into detail, just to point out to you that there are seven major parties that we really need to be concerned about. The others, in a sense, almost don't matter. Now, this is the most important thing I really wanted to get onto today, is the changes that there have been to the electoral system in the last 12 months or so with new legislation, and the huge political effects that are resulting from these relatively small changes. In Australian terms, they've been seen as big changes, but when you think of how much change there has been in Indonesia in the last 10 years, as I said, this is sort of fine-tuning, but their effects will be tremendous. The most important thing, and this is a summary first of all, is that the new regulations have changed the way the campaign is being fought. And they will also alter the composition of the DPR. They'll change who, what parties win seats and the individuals who take up those seats. It will also affect the way the coalitions are formed for the presidential electoral campaign. And a very important thing is that now the intervention of the Constitutional Court, its decisions have on the electoral laws have changed the rules of the game in ways that the legislators really did not expect. And this is a really important new player, the Constitutional Court. All right, the really important change that has happened gradually since 1999 and then rapidly in the last few months is a movement from a closed list proportional representation system to an open list PR system. A closed list system basically being one where people only have the opportunity to vote for a party, to an open list system where people, voters, choose individual candidates. Now, there's a spectrum across the world of systems like that. Indonesia really has now gone from one extreme to the other, one end of the spectrum to another. And that has gradually happened since the 1999 election. In 1999, there was a closed list system. Voters could only vote for a party, vote for a party symbol. Names of candidates were not even mentioned, I think, in 99 ballot papers. And the parties listed their candidates in strict order. As I was just thinking, I don't think their names were even mentioned on the ballot paper. So they just gave the names to the KPU, the Election Commission, in the strict order. And so the person at the top, of course, would be elected. Person below him or her, second chances of being elected, and so forth. But of course the point is that the voters didn't make that choice. It was the parties essentially who made the choice. This was widely criticised. Criticising for allowing the domination by party leaders, by party machines. It meant that MPs basically ignored their constituency because the people voting for them weren't actually the ones who ensured them getting their seat. The important thing was to get on top of the list. And who was to give you that position? The party machine. So they were the people that you were concerned about. Constituents, they were almost irrelevant. And had the situation that many candidates bought their position on the party ticket. Now, of course, you can imagine the avenues of corruption that led to. If you pay a lot of money to get your place on the party ticket, you would recoup that money plus more when you're in power. In 2004, there was some reform, but it was a pretty minor reform. It meant that voters could also vote for a candidate. But if you voted for a candidate, an individual candidate, you also had to vote for that candidate's party. If you didn't do that, your vote was invalid. And I don't have anywhere near enough time to go through the intricacies of that system, but the result of it was that there was actually only two seats that were won through individual votes. All of them other seats were allocated on the basis of position on the party ticket. And this was though, even though 52% of voters did actually mark an individual candidate. And that's an important figure for what I'm about to say. That's important for indicating just the unbalanced nature of that system, but also it's important for a point that I want to make in a moment. But, hang on, that but is at the end of that slide. The 2009 electoral law moved one step further towards an open list system. It said that voters could vote for a candidate or for a party, so they didn't have to vote for both of them. And there was a bit of ambiguity about this. If you did both, it's now been ruled that if you mark both, that will be a valid vote. Now, this again is a complicated technical thing. but I do need to mention it, that candidates, when it came to the question of allocating who within a party would actually receive the seat, there was this system that which was in the electoral law saying that those candidates who received 30% plus of a quota of personal votes would be put into the count for the allocation of seats. All of this was an attempt to move away from the domination of the party list. So that if a party, for example, won 3 seats within an electoral district and it had 2 candidates with 30% plus of a quota of personal votes, that is votes for them as an individual, those 2 candidates would take up the seats. And the 3rd seat would be allocated to the candidate who was number one on the party list. That's just an example. Now, this greatly increased the chances of an election on personal votes, but they were still waiting for the party list. But, this is where the but comes in, along came the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court, some individuals took this law to the court for a judicial review. Constitutional Court ruled that law was unconstitutional, or that aspect of the law was unconstitutional. It declared that the party list waiting was to be contrary to the Constitution. And they said that candidates with the largest number of votes should be allocated seats. That only candidates with the largest number of votes, that should be the system, regardless of whether they got 30% of a quota or not. So what we see then is a situation now where parties, individual candidates' personal vote becomes the crucial thing. And this, of course, will increase the number of voters who do vote for an individual. If you remember, as I said, that even in the older system, 52% of people still voted for an individual candidate. Under this system, that really encourages people to vote for an individual. But it still leaves open the question of what to do with the party-only votes, that is, people who only vote for their party. There's a whole controversy about that, which is yet to be settled. I mean, which, is, of course, is a bit of a worry, given that the election is only a month away and basic questions like this have not yet been resolved. And unfortunately, the government seems to be leaving this question to the General Elections Commission. It's really giving up its prerogative or its responsibility as executive government and foisting it onto the KPU to make important decisions like that, which will have a lot of effect on the outcome and which, if it's unclear, could result in a lot of disputation after the election. People lose seats because of the way the KPU interpreted the Constitutional Court's ruling, and there may be a lot of disputes after the election. A lot of them are coming. So the political effects. I'm running out of time, but this is probably the most important thing I wanted to get across today, is that campaign strategies have completely changed as a result of the Constitutional Court's decisions. It shifted the focus of campaigns from the party to the individual candidates. The effect is something like Robson rotation is in the ACT in Tasmania, where the whole focus of things becomes the individual candidate. Previously dominated by national leaders, party propaganda, party material, and individual candidates' material, now focuses on local candidates. Campaigns are being led by the candidates themselves rather than being led by the party, which was previously the case. And there's been reports to me personally, and I've heard through various sources, of candidates that have demanded their money back from the party because they paid their money on the basis of the old system. Suddenly the system's changed. Position on party list, it's worthless. Previously it was worth a lot of money. Now it's worthless. So people actually demanding their money back because now they've got a campaign for themselves. And the other thing that's happening, which is what Robson rotation does, is the candidates of the same party are now competing against each other. And a particular manifestation of that is that there's been a lot of candidates reporting on each other within the same party to the Elections Oversight Committee, saying, oh, that person was violating the election rules here and that
person was doing it there and so forth. It's a real indication of the intensity of the competition between candidates within the one party, and it's starting to happen. It was not a feature of elections before. As I said, the fact that the government has shifted a lot of the decisions about the fine points of this system to the KPU has created a lot of uncertainty and a lot of potential for problems after the election. Now, I just wanted to give you some of the examples of the, what shall I say, idiosyncratic way that some people have decided to launch their own campaigns. This is a candidate who has no better attribute than the fact that he is the father of this pop star. Papanya Cynthia, vote for me. The other thing he's saying too, which is a very common thing, that he's saying he's a son of the soil of Abubis area. So this is something that's also starting to become emphasised a lot. Candidates saying, yes, I'm really from this area. I'm not from the party, I'm from this area. Couldn't resist showing those support. But you also notice the only reference to the party is just a small little symbol up there. And similarly, I mean, this is a candidate from Golkar who you would think would get better advice on his campaign than that, but the previous candidate was an insignificant party. Whereas this is Golkar, it's only just mentioned there in the party symbol, although it would be widely recognised. But that's the best they've come up with. And there's actually been a website I discovered this morning. There's actually been a website set up publicising all of these ridiculous examples of campaigning. And the best one that they saw, and I just had to put it on for you today, is this one. Oh, don't tell me it's not going to work. But what it was a picture of Osama bin Laden and Osama and Obama, shaking hands, and in between them was the candidate. That's such a pity it didn't work. I don't know why. But I don't quite know what the point he was making there, but somehow he thought that was useful. How are we going for the time?
Pretty close. Okay.
Have you got
much more?
Oh, I've got a heap more, but obviously I'm not going to
get through it all. Another few minutes.
Yeah, okay. So that's what the ballot paper roughly looks like. Voters can either vote a tick on a candidate or a party symbol, or they can do both. But of course not pick a party here and a candidate there. That would be invalid. And it seems, I think it can be predicted, that a great majority of people will vote for candidates. All right, very quickly I might just mention these two things, a couple of things, and then stop. The other important changes in the electoral law were the threshold for parliamentary seats. I have mentioned this briefly. That 2.5% of the vote is now the minimum, so that a party might win a seat within one electorate. They might win, say, 10% of the seats in one particular district, but if they don't win 2.5% nationally, they will not be allocated seats. And that will remove, or that would have removed, all but one of the minor parties in the current DPR. You remember I showed you the big seven? All of those parties are the only ones that would meet that threshold, except for this one party that just would scrape through it. So all of those parties that a lot of people talk about as being such a significant party system would be eliminated.
How many parties are standing this time?
38 parties. Yeah. And there's also six regional parties in Aceh. Aceh is the only place where regional parties can stand. There's 38. All right, and this is the other interesting thing, is affirmative action for women candidates. The new electoral law said that parties' lists must contain 30% of female candidates. The sanction for non-compliance on that was very, very weak, just simply that the KPU, the Electoral Commission, would publish the parties who didn't comply. But all the major parties have actually complied with that. But the other interesting thing was that the law also said that one in three candidates in a list should be a female. In other words, you couldn't dump all your female candidates in unwinnable seats. this is usually known in the international literature as a zipper system. And that was expected to increase the chances for women candidates because it put them higher, or increased their chances of being higher, relatively high, on the party list. But, remember, Constitutional Court said party list system is unconstitutional. They immediately wiped out the whole of the affirmative action effect of that provision in the electoral law. So the 30% of candidates are still there, but the practical effect of the zipper provision has been eliminated. Okay. I think I've probably introduced the presidential system enough. As if we run out of time, maybe I should finish there.
Thank you. Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Greg Feeley. Greg holds a joint appointment as a fellow and senior lecturer in Southeast Asian politics at the Research School of the Pacific and Asian Studies and the Faculty of Asian Studies at the ANU in Canberra. His main research interests are Islam and post-independence Indonesian politics. He gained his PhD from Monash University in 1998 with a study of the history of Can you understand why I didn't get that? Published in Indonesian, with a little bit more that I can't understand. He's the author of Joining the Caravan, The Middle East, Islamist and Indonesia 2005, Radical Islam and Terrorism in Indonesia 2005, and Zealous Democrats 2008. He's also the co-editor of Expressing Islam, Religious Life and Politics in Indonesia 2008, Voices of Islam in Southeast Asia, a Contemporary Sourcebook 2006, Local Power and Politics in Indonesia, Decentralisation and Democratisation 2003, and Traditionalism and Modernity in Indonesia 1995. He was the C.V. Starr Visiting Professor in Indonesian Politics at the John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, Washington DC in 2003, and has been a consultant to AusAid, USAID, Asia at the Asia Foundation and BP. From 1997 to 1999, he was an Indonesia an analyst at the Australian Government's Office of National Assessments. Ladies and gentlemen, would you welcome Dr. Greg Feeley. Along the top line.
The very top.
Very top.
Just one
of them.
That one?
That
no.
Yes.
Along to the right.
Yeah. Just, oh, slide. Yeah, it's okay. See it. Yep.
And from beginning.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, well, Stephen's given a really lucid picture of what's a very complicated electoral system. What I'm going to spend most of my time talking about is the parties that make up and main candidates that make up that electoral system who will be competing in both the parliamentary elections and the presidential elections. So, as Stephen mentioned, there are 38 parties currently competing in Indonesia. There are only 24 in 2004, and the reason that we have, because the trend in Indonesian politics has been to try and simplify the system, have less parties, less complicated ballot papers and things like that. But because of a lot of horse trading, or shall we call it cow trading, going on in Parliament, we ended up with 38 parties. Most of these parties we don't need to worry about too much because most of them will come nowhere near to meeting those thresholds that Stephen was talking about. But there are probably about 10 parties sort of worthy of close consideration. Now, one thing is, how do we try to generalise about this? How can we categorise these parties? Historically, people have often used either religion or ideology to group them. So we have Christian parties, Islamic parties, secular nationalist parties. But one of the things that's been happening in Indonesia in the last 10, 15 years or so is that the kind of clear boundaries that once used to divide political parties are much less in evidence now. They are for some parties, but there's a lot of parties that actually partly straddle categories, so it's become much less clear-cut. There's a number of reasons for this. One thing is that Indonesian politics is becoming much more like Western politics. The art of political polling, for example, is becoming much more sophisticated, and parties are prepared to pay quite large sums of money for people to have scientific polling of electorate wishes. And so one of the things this does is that everyone wants votes in that big mainstream. So they find out what the mainstream wants and then they tailor their message accordingly. So we find this congregation of many parties in the middle of the political spectrum. So some of the differences, particularly during election time, are being blurred over. Also important to note, a great many of these parties are largely vehicles, personal vehicles, electoral vehicles for wealthy or powerful individuals. Many of the new parties formed, for example, have only got a very small number of members. There's formal criteria they have to go to be registered, but in actual fact it's quite easy to meet those. So, having said to you the boundaries are blurred, I'm now going to group these parties according to nationalist and Islamic. But if you keep in the back of your mind, that's not all these parties are. So the first sort of kind of, to apply this loose category of nationalist parties, is Partai Demokrat, or the Democrat Party, which was basically formed purely as an electoral vehicle for the current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. His son-in-law is a chair of the party. His wife is actually, we don't hear much about Ibu Ani, the president's wife, but she's in fact a very important figure behind the scenes in his party. And she's quite a politically astute person. In some ways, I think she's much more astute than what the president is in organising campaigns and things like that. Great many of the party members come from the military background, as indeed does SBY himself, with bureaucratic backgrounds. The party was one of the big surprises in 2004. It came from nowhere, from 0% to gain over 7% of the vote. So that was a big surprise. Now, the recent polling has been really encouraging for Partai Demokrat. The latest unreleased figures from one of the main survey organisations, LSI, has the party in the mid 20% range, which makes it the biggest party now, the largest party. So if that polling is accurate, if that trend continues until the 9th of April, well then SBY will already, with his own party, have enough support to be nominated for the presidency in one go. He won't have to seek a coalition of parties. He will anyway, but he won't have to.
Dr. Kelly,
yes.
I think there's a brother-in-law, not a
son-in-law. Oh, sorry, for Imam Utama?
Habib Utama?
Yeah. Son-in-law, okay. My apologies. Brother-in-law, not son-in-law. My apologies. So brother-in-law, and he's got other family members who are also on the central board of Partai Demokrat as well. And I'll talk a little later on about there's a dynastic thread running through this as well, but I'll come to that in the final slide. Now, one of the important things about this, I said as a personal vehicle, what does a party stand for? There are some general vague mission statements that Partai Demokrat has. But what it doesn't really have is a well-developed ideology. They have a very clever political analyst, a former chairman of one of the main Muslim student organisations called Anis Ubaningrum. And one of his jobs was to come up with an ideology for the party. And he worked away at this quite diligently for some 2 years. And the end result has been a very bland, generalised statement. Recently, business leaders met leaders from Partai Demokrat, had something like a 2-hour session with them to discuss their vision. and they came away and said, we could find no vision for this party. After 2 hours, we kept on asking them. They believe in things like stable government and economic growth, which everyone believes in, but there was no ideological content. Not so surprising, a lot of Indonesian parties are in that case, but here's the single largest party, which is, to a great degree, trading on the popularity of the president. When the president's popularity drops, the popularity of Partai Demokrat drops. So this is different from what we're used to in a lot of Western democratic systems. We come to the Nationalist Party, now the Nationalist Party, PDIP, chaired by Megawati Sukarnoputri. There she is pictured in front of her father, Sukarno. There's also another dynastic element to this, which I'll come to, but this party got 19% in 2004 and 34%, by far the largest party, in the 1999 election. Interestingly, Indonesia really doesn't have a tradition of opposition parties, or it hasn't since 1960. And PDIP has been distinctive because it's positioned itself as the overt opposition party to the government. And it's really been the only major party that's been wanting to play this kind of role. And it's done very well because of that, particularly when the government has been unpopular for decisions it's made. There's been a spike in the popularity of PDIP. And the polls range anywhere between 15 and about 25%. There is, by the way, mushrooming of the number of polling organisations in Indonesia in recent years, so much so that the election commission that Stephen was talking about has been wanting to register them. They're resisting that. But quite a few of these smaller, newer organisations, very dodgy, you know, push polling, all those kinds of things are now becoming possibilities in Indonesia. I'll come back and talk about Megawati in the context of presidential election, but she's both a plus and a minus. For a lot of people, she symbolises this national spirit of Indonesia, going right back to her father, who's seen as very much the founding father of Indonesia, the seminal figure in Indonesia's establishment. And so she benefits from that. She's got other elements to her legitimacy as well. But there are also some big problems with the way in which Megawati plays politics, which greatly hamper her party. If she was more effective as an opposition leader, as effective as some of her members of parliament are, well then the party would probably be doing much better than it is now. The last party in this category is a major party, is Golkar. This is a former Suharto regime party. It's largely remade itself since Suharto's downfall in 1998, and currently it's chaired by Vice President Yusuf Kalla. Got 22% of the vote in 1999 and about the same again in 2004. This is really the toughest political machine. This is the nearest thing Indonesia has to, say, the New South Wales Labor Party right wing. Very hard-headed, experienced politicians, a very effective machine, and it's been able to maintain power in a lot of the regions across Indonesia, and it's one of the parties that has a very professional outlook to campaigning, particularly in use of polls. Now, the polling for the party has actually been going down in recent months, and one figure had it down 15%. Yusuf Kalla is this man in the middle. It's been, he says internal party polling shows it's over 20%. Who knows? I'll come back and talk a little bit about him. One problem Golkar has is it doesn't have a strong presidential candidate. And a lot of the people, including those people on the other side of him, are encouraging Yusuf Kalla to stand in the presidential election, in full knowledge that he's going to be defeated in a dramatic way, and then that will open the party leadership to them. So people like Surya Paloh and Agung Laksono are two people that are saying, yes, we should nominate you. But it's really as much because they want to drag him down as because they want to push Golkar up. There's a couple of smaller nationalist parties, the Hanura Party of Hati Nurani Party of General Ranto, and also Prabowo Subianto, another general, defence general, has got Gerindra Party. Again, these parties are drawing very heavily on their old military networks, much like SBY did for Partai Demokrat. They draw some ex-Golkar people in as well. And they're interesting because both parties are very well cashed up. Prabowo and Wiranto are very wealthy men. Prabowo in particular is paid for the most sophisticated TV advertisement campaign that we've seen in an Indonesian election. And the ads are very glossy, the kind of things you would see in a really slick US or Australian style advertising campaign. And for a while they were showing at almost saturation levels. During peak period of television you'd see these ads coming on two or three times in a 1 hour program. And as a result of that, Provola's popularity and identification with the electorate really rose up to about 8%. I think it's the high point for that. The economic crisis has hit him and his brother, Hashim Joya Hadikusuma, very hard, but apparently they still have money salted away to pay for continuing ads. If they keep those going during the election campaign, he'll do quite well. Rogo put his money into on-the-ground campaigning, so it's harder to assess that, but he's had much less impact. So I suspect that they'll clear the threshold, but they won't get more than 3-4% of the votes. This brings me to Islamic parties, and I need to hurry up here. Important to note that not all Islamic parties are the same. There's really a major cleavage between them. On one side you have what we might call, not a perfect name, but pluralist Islamic parties, and on the other side we have the Islamist parties. Difference between them is how ideologically driven they are by Islamic principles and Islamic law. The Islamic parties, the pluralist parties, they rely on their support in the Islamic community. Their leaders are from particular organisations in the Islamic community. They often have Islamic symbols, but their ideological basis is not Islam, and they do not have a pro-Sharia agenda. So the Islamist parties are quite different. They will be ideologically based on Islam, and therefore to be registered as a party you have to say what your ideological basis is. So they're ideologically based on Islam formally, and also they want much more comprehensive implementation of Sharia law. Some of them even talk about an Islamic state for Indonesia in the longer term. So that's the difference really between the two. So let's divide it up that way. The pluralist parties, the largest of them in terms of, not in terms of seats in parliament, but in terms of the vote that they get in the elections, is PKB. This was a party that was built around Abdurrahman Wahid al-Kustur, the former president. He's now estranged from the party. He may have even, in fact, formally left it. I'm not quite sure of the status. Perhaps he's not even sure of the status.
He's called for a boycott of the vote.
Indeed, but I think formally, if you go to their website, he is still listed as Ketua Dewan Shura, the Ketua of the Religious Advisory Board. I've never seen any reference to him formally resigning, but indeed, as you say, he's called for a boycott of the party, which is actually the thing that I was dreading. The party's been split down the middle, basically, for much of its life. A lot to do with people falling out with Gusdur, who's got a very autocratic style of running the party. Now this photo here is a classic photo. This is his nephew, Mohaimin Iskandar. Some of you may know he's a Deputy Speaker of Parliament, of the Indonesian Parliament, and the current chairman of the party. And this is Yeni Wahid, Abdurrahman Wahid's daughter. And this was at the declaration where the KPU declared the parties and their ballot numbers, where they would come on the ballot. So here is when they called out PKB, and I forget the number of that it is. Anyway, two people came up to collect it. Mohaimin, he grabbed it, and Yeni came along and said, hold on, I'm going to have that as well. So they were both there, and they actually almost had to be separated, and so the party's got this photo. So the courts favoured Mohaimin Iskandar as the chairman, so he's now the formal chairman, and that's what the election commission has also ruled. But the fact that Gusdur has come out and said boycott the election, and it makes it very likely he's also going to really bash Mohaimin coming into the campaign proper, that will really do big harm to the party. Moving on very quickly, founded by Amin Rice. Here's a picture of Amin Rice there. He's now stood down. He stood down several years ago. He's been replaced by a businessman, sort of slightly playboyish kind of figure, Sir Tristan Buckingham. He's a bit of a comical person, actually. He has really got no idea at all about politics, but he's got lots of money. Well, he did have until the financial crisis. So he's been bankrolling all sorts of things. Nothing has stopped the slide in Parliament's vote. This is really one of those organisations that depends on support from one particular part of the Islamic community. So this party will probably sink below about 4% in the election. Every chance of it doing that. The Islamist parties, there are really three here. The main one, the largest of them, is PPP, which got about 11% in 1999, 8% in 2004. This is a very demoralised party. It has a very lacklustre chairman, and a lot of its board are older men who have not really had much public profile and are really fighting yesterday's battles quite often. So PPP is one of these Islamist parties that's likely to go down in a dramatic way. Bulan Bintang is a party that could well struggle to meet that 2.5% threshold. Its chairman is public reputation probably has him as one of the most corrupt ministers in the cabinet. He is constantly mentioned in connection with forestry scandals, and my own personal view, if SBY had been both politically savvy and also determined on and corruption issues, it would have forced him to stand down from parliament. But all that's having a very big impact on Bulan Bintang. Well, the most interesting of the Islamist parties is PKS. This is Muslim Brotherhood inspired party. The polling for this party is not actually very good, but I suspect the pollsters have always underestimated the support for this party, and it's got a prospect. It got 7% in 2004, having only got 1% in 1999. There's a good chance it will be above 10%. So that'll make it quite a big player. It's the best organised of the parties, and it's one of the few parties that's really serious about policy. It has a 400-page policy platform book that it's published, a very detailed document. So overall, for Islamic parties, prospects are grim. They got about 38% of the vote in 2004. There's a good chance that will be well under 30% unless the pollsters are completely wrong. And that's because of a number of things, their internal problems, poor leadership. And as I say, the only exception to that may well be that PKS party. Just a couple of last things before I talk very, very quickly. I'm sorry for your indulgence about presidential elections. Anyone know who this person is? The Indonesian staff members will know who this person is. This person perhaps less well known, but this is Puan Mahathir, who is the daughter of Megawati Soekarnoputri, and Mega, she's a candidate in Central Java for PDIP, and Megawati is making no secret of the fact she wants Puan to succeed her. I've seen a number of television interviews with Puan, and they are funny in an excruciating way because she has almost nothing of interest to say. It was embarrassing for her. She's really intellectually quite ill-equipped for the role that her mother wants to put her into, but it continues the family line. This is Edi Baksoro, that's his name, isn't it? And his mother, that's Ibu Ani Basari Kristani, SBY's wife, and he is also a candidate for Partai Demokrat in this election. And one can imagine what career he might have in front of him if he's elected. So there are lots of other people. Amin Rais's son is a candidate in the election. There are all sorts of other senior politicians who have now put their children in. We've seen this trend in Malaysia where almost every senior politician has a family member coming in. We're seeing a lot of that in Indonesia too. So presidential elections. Just a comment on Stephen's presentation about presidential elections. His threshold of 20%, there was a huge amount of debate about this and whether it was too high or not. So it's 20% of the seats in Parliament or 25% of the national vote. That's a very high threshold, and it basically means you'll have two at the most three candidates. It's possible we may only have one candidate. You could draw a scenario where SBY's popularity goes up, all the parties see that he's the obvious winner, the almost automatic winner, and they say, why should we risk being on the outer? Why don't we sue for peace and get a few seats in cabinet and things like that? And Megawati has made it clear she does not want another humiliation. She was very bitter about her defeat in 2004. She doesn't want to repeat of that. And it may be a case, if her polling figures go down, that she withdraws from presidential election. Chances are there would be another candidate of some sort, but it would be basically a one-horse race. As long as Mega remains in the race, it's definitely a two-horse race. In all the parties, I think, as Stephen mentioned, everyone's waiting to see the outcome of the legislative elections on the 9th of April before they finalise their deals. They've all got preferences, but no one wants to lock themselves into an alliance until they see those figures. So that's why it's an extremely fluid situation now and a very hazardous situation to make predictions about. So SPY is a clear front runner. He's also, at the moment, he's got almost double support of Megawati, according to the LSI polling, the latest LSI polling. Overall approval rating has him at over 50, almost 60%, in fact, which is the approval rating he had when he was first elected. So he's looking a sure thing at the moment. Very safe, decent person, worthy. People find him a bit boring. They fall asleep during his speeches. A bit indecisive, but overall, he's been a solid leader for Indonesia. People like the way, in general terms, he goes about running the country. And the economic results have been really quite good if you consider what's happening to countries like Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand. And SPY has a very successful anti-poverty campaign, which has really become the centrepiece of his re-election. And the advertisements talking about how to bring down prices, relieving poverty, and it's one reason why he's doing so well in the polls. Megawati should be much closer to SPY than she is. She has a very smart political team around her who keep on crafting her good strategies and good speeches to attack SPY. And lots of times she won't deliver them. So they might have a clever statement in a speech and she'll throw the screw speech up and then lambast the voters for not voting her in 2004. If SPY is bad, well, you had the opportunity a few years ago, you didn't vote me in, so it's your fault that we're stuck with this. So all the bitterness comes out and the headline becomes Megawati, sort of Menegur, Suarez, Megawati goes crook at the voters, rather than Megawati attacks SPY. So there's lots of these sort of things that happen. And she should be doing much better than she is. She's a poor campaigner. And once we get into the campaign proper for the presidential elections, the chances are she will fall further behind. And that's about the end of it, by looks of it. So I'll leave it there. I'm happy to answer questions on any things that I haven't covered for this.
Thank you, Greg. Look, I'm conscious of time, but I think if Wilma's our guests are quite happy, we'll have a couple of questions if people have them. No? It has been a really... Sorry, here's one over here. Yes.
Why the exclusive use of parties and not independent candidates? Was it because of fear of fragmentation? Or?
I thought you... I think, yes, partly it was an issue of fear of fragmentation. There's an underlying discourse about threats to the unity of Indonesia, which is part of it. I mean, that was the justifiable rationale. I mean, the unspoken, less justifiable rationale is that the parties wanted to maintain their domination of politics. And I think the latter really is the larger reason for that. There's a lot of pressure from NGO groups and so forth to introduce independent candidates. And there's some possibility that may happen, but so far the parties have resisted that.
Thank you.
I think just on that, I think the self-interest of the parties is a very strong element in this, and even though it's now become legally possible for there to be independent candidates in the regional elections of Pilkada, we find Parliament seeking to block or frustrate the implementation of this. And there's also a question of whether we could have independent candidates in the presidential election. And also there was a lot of resistance from the parties within Parliament because they basically don't see it as in their interest to have the system opened up in that way.
John? My question goes to the strength of the party over its members on the floor of Parliament. How significant is party membership as opposed to geographic representation in shaping an MP's position on an issue?
Well, my response on that, just having done quite a lot of work observing the operation of the Parliament, is that the opinion of individual members is not actually especially important. One particularly unusual feature of the Indonesian Parliament is that voting never happens. Issues are not decided by votes, by joining votes or not. Everything happens supposedly by consensus, which basically means that individual members can say what they want, whatever they want, in committee meetings and so forth. And being a presidential system, most decisions about legislation are made in individual committees.
rather than on a plenary session like in our system. So most bills are never discussed outside their committee. So what one member will say during the debate on things can be all over the place, but it doesn't matter particularly, because the end result is really determined by the leaders of the caucuses. And it's the supposed consensus amongst those caucus leaders which will decide something. But within the tremendous limitations of that system, what particular members say is generally not largely determined by their geographical location. From issue to issue, it will change, of course, but partly because of the electoral system that I mentioned before, most members' connections in their constituencies are very weak. This new system will change a lot of that, but currently people are still very Jakarta focused, and important exceptions apart, most members do not have a strong sense of representing a constituency in the way in which they do in Australian Parliament or most Westminster systems.
That's something for that. I think a lot, what Stephen says, if you go along the plenary session of Parliament, it's the view of the fraxy or the fraction, each of the party caucuses. So that's the view that's conveyed. But earlier on in the legislative process, there is room for individual members to basically lobby on behalf of their home districts on certain issues. A lot of issues is exactly as Stephen says, but there's certain issues which may be important to them, things to do with, say, industries that are the basis of the economy in that province. And if a member gets on, a lot of the work is done in commissions. It's not done in the plenary session of Parliament, it's done in commissions and the subcommittees. And so if you have members who have a strong interest in a topic, they'll often get on the subcommittee and they'll push very hard. They'll say that this is going to be a great harm to the area where I come from. You even see on the issue of partitioning of provinces and districts, which is big business for Parliament. So a lot of parliamentarians make a lot of money is by putting forward claims to create a new district or a new province. And it's often local members serving this local constituency in that form as well. And there's been a lot of criticism of this. We've had this explosion in the number of districts. I think you had to figure up, Stephen, the 489. It was around about, what was it, when Suharto left office just 10 years ago, it was about 200 or so, I think. So it's more than doubled in that time. And one reason is because there's no break on this in Parliament. It's very lucrative. It looks as if Parliament's doing things by passing legislation, and it also makes a local member seem like he's supporting local aspirations. So there are some anomalies in this as well.
Are there any further questions?
One more. You mentioned the, I can't remember what it's called, but their equivalent of our electoral commission. Could you expand on how people end up on that commission? Are they appointed? By whom? Sort of how neutral, I suppose, is it?
Yes, that's a very big and very problematic question. And it's supposedly, it's just on the appointment of the members of the commission. Takes place through a quite formally strict and exhaustive sort of process of elimination of candidates on the basis of qualifications and background and psychological tests and so forth. But and this is always difficult to document, but through the reports that one reads and hears, there are a lot of flaws in how the process actually happens, and that the Parliament and the government tend to have a preset list of people who they will want to be put onto the KPU, and they'll weed them out regardless of how formally correct the system is. And the other important point to make about the KPU is that it changes every 5 years, which can have major problems in administrative and policy continuity, because every time you've got a completely new set of people, they approach the issues in a different sort of way. There isn't a corporate memory except in the secretariat of the KPU. And I'd have to say that the current KPU has not developed as good a reputation as the previous KPU. And this is an example of the sort of problem that I'm talking about. But because it changes every 5 years, there can be problems in transition between the two and the quality of the commission.
Last one.
Just quickly come on. There's a selection committee within Parliament that appoints the members of the committee. And following what Stephen was saying, it was notable on this occasion, previous KPUs, actually the first KPU in 99 was a bit of a disaster because they had representatives from all the parties on it, but the last KPU, the 2004, actually had most of the people on there could rightly be regarded as experts in politics or elections and things like that. So I was quite confident, even though about half of them ended up on corruption charges and several are still in jail, but nonetheless, I was quite confident doing what they're doing. The current election commission is notable because I think the only person who had any previous experience on running an election at a district level or provincial level, he was originally prevented from going on because there was some corruption question about him. And I think he ended up on there, but the chairman and most of the people had no background in running an election. And from what people like Stephen and I hear on the ground, there's people are actually quite despairing of the lack of expertise on the KPU. So this, in a way, could be the most complicated election to run, and we have the least competent election commission to oversee it.
One thing that has often been said in the media is that they lack a sense of urgency and even a sense of crisis, because there are a lot of things, these regulatory issues, but there's also a lot of issues emerging with the logistics of the election, a lot of concern about ballot papers are not getting to the right places and so forth, and that this KPU is lacking any sense that there is an emerging crisis, and going off on study trips to Cuba and places like that. So,
Right, last question. Did you have a question?
Look, this is really broad, but it's very striking that the elections are taking place in a serious international economic crisis. You mentioned, Greg, that Indonesia's done comparatively better than a number of other Southeast Asian countries so far, and like the proportion of trade in GDP is quite a bit lower than some other Southeast Asian countries, so the country's not as exposed overall. But do you both think that the international financial crisis context has the potential still to add a bit of volatility to the elections and the balance of forces? And can you see international economic events still having a significant sort of influence on the character of the context, particularly for the presidential campaign? Or do you think it will, as seems to have been recently, act to underscore the position of SPY?
It's a big unknown in a way. I think what surprised quite a few of us in the past, whenever SPY dipped in the polls, and for a while Megawati was ahead of SPY in the middle of last year, there's several polls that had him about 4 or 5 points behind her. And whenever he's dipped in the polls, it's been due to an economic issue. For example, the reduction in subsidies, which for fuel prices, which resulted in sharp increases, which had a really hard impact on a lot of poorer people. So he's always paid a heavy price for that, as have other major parties in the government. The difference this time seems to be that, one, he's not specifically targeting subsidies, and in fact, if I'm correct, they've restored some of the subsidies on fuel, haven't they? Is that right? But the other thing has been the success in trying to have compensation mechanisms in place for poorer sections of the community. In the past, it was very easy for this money to be filtered off, for bureaucratic inefficiencies meant a lot of people at grassroots didn't get the money. But they are now, and that's what his campaign has been really emphasising, these large advertisements, full-page advertisements, in papers and in magazines and on TV as well. So that's one thing that's, in a way, not only probably insulated him from a
an economic, from a political backlash for the economic downturn, but also a main thing positive, much like other governments that are seen to be doing something to alleviate the effects of this are also being rewarded by the community. However, if the economic crisis were to get a lot worse and there were to be some large layoffs or some really dramatic economic impact on ordinary Indonesians, that may end up having an impact on him because the electorate may well become more attuned to a more dramatic message. For example, Prabowo and Wiranto both campaigned very heavily on economic nationalism and saying that we need to have less connection with the Islamic, with the international community, we have to be more self-sufficient, we have to do more pump priming, these kinds of things which international investors wouldn't like. So that might mean he's got to try and fight this battle about economic policy on a different front if things get worse. But at the moment, they're doing really. I think the growth rate, the predicted growth is about 5% for the next year, even though it's about a 3% slowdown in the last quarter. So I think it's somewhere around about there, about 5% or so.
Yes, 5.5%.
Sorry,
5.5%.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, look, I think we're going to call a halt there because we are a bit over time. And, firstly, in thanking our two guest speakers, can I say that some of the statistics you showed us were quite staggering. I remember in 1999, 120 million, I think, registered voters. Now 170 million, 10 years later. 330,000 polling stations in 1999, and 600,000 now. I mean, if you're providing two domestic monitors, as you did in 1999, that's 1.2 million you have to find two monitors. But the thing that, and I won't ask you to comment on now, is that with the new thresholds that are in place, I wondered, as you were going through the figures, I think it was, who was showing the figures, that Amin Rais's party, I think, polled somewhere between 7 and 8% in 1999, but it was a very concentrated vote. And I wonder whether or not they would have passed the threshold of getting to the threshold in two-thirds of the provinces in Indonesia back in 1999, if that had been in place then. Because it was he had a very concentrated vote, and this is going to put a different emphasis on voting patterns throughout the country, where some parties that poll very well, for instance in Jakarta, are going to have to get past the threshold in the outlying provinces. It's very interesting. But on behalf of everyone present, can I say thank you very much to both of you for giving us your time today. And would you please accept a little bit of light reading, courtesy of Roxanne and the library. and thank you all for your attendance. And if you'll excuse me, I think the Court of Estimates will get me back very soon. thank you very much. Thanks, good to see you. Thanks, Roxanne.
Thank you very much.
That's right.
Enjoy your
Thank you.